This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.EDU. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining us this afternoon. The scope of the AIDS pandemic in Africa is very difficult to comprehend. How do you try to understand the impact of a disease that afflicts tens of millions of people, a treatable, preventable disease that kills thousands every day? Journalist Stephanie Nolan says she looked at AIDS in Africa for a long time before she understood what she was seeing. One day in a Malawi village, she realized AIDS wasn't a story of statistics, but of men, women, and children. She realized that if people weren't sick, they were caring for the sick. Looking back on that day, she says, one way or another, everyone had the disease. She says she, quoting here, had the sense of a community quietly evaporating. Stephanie Nolan is our guest in this portion of the program. She is the only Western journalist currently dedicated solely to covering AIDS in Africa. She's the award-winning Africa correspondent for Toronto's Globe and Mail. She's also the author of 28 Stories of AIDS in Africa. The book tells the stories of 28 people in 14 countries in sub-Saharan Africa who are affected by the pandemic. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with your questions and comments. You can join us with a telephone call. Excuse me. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Excuse me. I've got a frog there. Stephanie Nolan, our guest, will be in Chicago tomorrow, May 10th, for a speaking engagement at the Chicago Council on Foreign Affairs, which is located at 55 East Ontario. That event is set for 6:30 p.m. Tickets are involved, so for more information, give them a call there at the Chicago Council on Foreign Affairs. That's tomorrow, May 10th, 2007. Stephanie Nolan's book, 28, Stories of AIDS in Africa, is published by Walker and Company. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Stephanie, welcome. It's good to talk with you.
Thank you very much, Celeste. Thanks for having me.
The thought of a village evaporating is a striking metaphor. And then not long after reading those words, readers will come to this sentence: it wasn't just one people being wiped out, but many of them, whole cultures. So why has the story of AIDS in Africa received so little coverage in the West?
Well, I mean, I guess the clue lies in the word evaporating. When something evaporates, it does it almost silently. You know, I'm a reporter, and I know that what makes the news, you know, we have a rather crass saying in the business, if it bleeds, it leads. AIDS isn't like a roadside bomb that wipes out all kinds of people in something gory that makes for good footage, or even like Ebola. People don't die spectacularly and quickly. They die really slowly. They die quietly. Well, in fact, you know, it's not quiet. When you die of AIDS in Africa, you very often people suffocate in their own lungs, and that, in fact, is not a quiet sound. But they're alone in their little houses in these villages, places that, you know, news crews never go, and we just don't ever hear their stories. And it's 10 years from the point when you get infected, usually, to the point where you get sick, and then another 3 or 4 or 5 years where you die, nursed by your children or your husband or the neighbors, and it's just not something that we've been paying attention to. I think also you talked a few minutes ago about the size of the numbers. 28 million people living with the virus in sub-Saharan Africa, what does that even mean, right? I mean, yeah. I'm Canadian. That's the population of my whole country. Mm-hmm. I think that's numbing, and I don't fault people at all for turning on the news, hearing that statistic, and turning it off again, because how do you even get your head around that?
Yeah, but as you point out a couple of times in the book, this is a treatable, preventable disease.
It is, and if you find out tomorrow in Illinois that you've got HIV, then if you're sick enough to need drugs, you'll be put on antiretrovirals, and you'll probably manage that disease like a chronic illness like diabetes for the rest of your life. Unfortunately, well, you know, I was about to say very few Africans have access to the treatment. I sh- should say, when I moved to Africa to start writing about this story, there were fewer than 100,000 people on treatment. That was 4 years ago. Now, when I left 2 weeks ago to come to North America, there were 1.5 million people on treatment, which is a 13-fold increase in just 4 years, and something that everybody said couldn't be done. That's the kind of happy story out of Africa that we don't hear very often here. It's also true, though, that that's only a quarter of the people sick enough to need the drugs, and the rest are still waiting. And it is preventable, and we know really, you know, that the things, some of the things that you can do to prevent the disease are pretty easy. And unfortunately, people in many areas of sub-Saharan Africa still don't have access to the education programs that would tell them how to do that, or access to the condoms. Access to, I mean, those are the easy ones. The harder ones are things like, you know, a lot of people who are vulnerable to the disease, it's because they don't have a choice except to sell sex, or they live in a culture, a lot of women live in cultures that don't give them the right to negotiate safer sex culturally. That stuff, of course, is all much harder to fix.
Yeah. This is The Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, journalist Stephanie Nolan, author of 28 Stories of AIDS in Africa. We have a listener waiting to talk with you, Stephanie, so let's go and take this call. A listener in Champaign on line one. Hi.
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 Ed, I'm George.
Hi, George.
Well, I'm actually from Africa, and unfortunately I found myself over here in the United States. My question has to do is, is she sent over there by the U.S. Department of Health, or she's just one of the private visitors to do a research?
She's a journalist. She's a reporter.
Oh, okay. And then what are she trying to do in order to help to prevent this spreading to the rest of the other people?
Well, I guess, George, I feel like it's my job to try and tell these stories, because the thing that I notice every time I come home, and you may have had this experience, is that people seem to feel like it's different when it happens in Africa. That if you find out, if you live in that little village in Malawi that Celeste was talking about, that if you find out you have HIV because you live in a country that has a drought or a periodic famine, or if you live in a place with a civil war, that somehow, you know, AIDS is just one more bad thing that happens to you in a place full of bad things. And that we don't tend to think of Africans as people who have the exact same expectations for their lives as we do for ours. So I know now from years of working in Africa and 4 years of writing this story full-time that when you are told in a little village in Malawi that you have HIV, it's every bit as devastating and every bit as horrifying. And I wanted to try and tell these personal stories to help people understand that, and also to provide, you know, I'm not a public health educator, I'm not a medical person, but I was aware that there were these extraordinary efforts being mounted within Africa to respond to the pandemic, real grassroots things of people in their neighborhoods taking care of sick people, looking after orphans, and that we never hear those stories. And I wanted to make sure that there was a record of at least some of them.
Well, I appreciate you going over there to Africa, but do you have another plan of going to some part of Africa besides Malawi?
I live in Johannesburg, and I routinely travel all over Africa. So I've reported from 37, I'm losing track. I've reported from 36 of the 53 countries in sub-Saharan Africa, and I'm hoping to get to the rest this year.
So you planning trying to go to the West?
I go to the West quite often, yeah.
Have you been to Liberia?
I have been to Liberia. I love Liberia.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks for the call. Other calls are invited. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. How did you convince your editors in Toronto that this was a story the Globe and Mail should be telling?
Well, I don't think I'm telling tales out of school if I say that it was a bit of a hard sell.
Yeah.
It was not at the top of their priority list, for sure. And you can't blame them for that, because it's not, if you're a media organization with finite resources, it's not the obvious place to put them. For the Globe, I covered the fall of Saddam Hussein in Iraq, and I covered the end of the Taliban in Afghanistan, and I would do these things that were officially the big story. And then when I wasn't doing those, I would go to Africa, and it wasn't a quick realization, but slowly I came to understand that the stories I was doing out of Africa were, in fact, much bigger stories. They involved far more people in critical situations, more, you know, not one country, but dozens of them. And I started a campaign. I stopped just short of a hunger strike to convince my editors that this actually was the biggest story. And they said, go for 6 months and start doing this and we'll see. And I think that they thought, frankly, I didn't think that they thought I would be there for very long. But to their credit, Globe readers responded with a lot of enthusiasm. And I think management at the paper was very surprised. The Globe is Canada's national newspaper, and it's distributed across the country. And I think they were very surprised when they held focus groups in different areas that people said that, in fact, the AIDS coverage was one of the things they valued most in the paper. I think media organizations have a tendency, and you will know this from public radio, to underestimate their audiences, and we weren't giving people credit for the fact that they wanted to know that this was happening. And I think lots of Americans have the sense that they would like to hear the individual voices of the people living in the pandemic, and that we don't get to do that very often.
Yeah. The first chapter tells the story of a remarkable woman named Spiwei. Where did you meet her? Tell us about her.
I met her at a meeting for people living with HIV in Swaziland. Spiwei is Swazi, and Swazi is a little country in southern Africa that has the highest HIV prevalence rate in the world. It's about 43%. And there were a lot of, I was there with a UN team that was on a fact-finding mission, and there were a lot of young people who were quite angry, quite legitimately angry, but speaking out in sort of ringing tones about the situation in their country. And after they had done lots of leaping up and shouting, Spiwei, who's about 5'3" and very round, stood up, and she had gray hair, and she had a very different sort of demeanor than a lot of these younger activists. And she started to speak in a very quiet voice, but in just a couple of minutes, she laid out for this team of visiting experts this extraordinary picture of her country, of all of the parentless children and all of the families left struggling because there was no one left to do the farming that most people survive on, and no young people left to go into the cities and do work for wages that they could bring home, that there was no space in the hospitals, no drugs in the clinic, no teachers left in the schools, that her whole country had been laid waste by this, and how few people there were left to mount any kind of response to that.
Hmm. She told you a story of going along in her vehicle, I think a truck, and she's one of the organizers of a group called Swaziland Positive Living. And so she has this truck, correct? And she's on the road, and somebody flags her down and directs her to a village of 300 people. In this village, 51 orphans.
Yeah, Spiwei, we were driving when she sort of leaned out the window of that little white truck with the big red AIDS ribbon on the doorway and pointed to this village and just quite matter-of-factly told me this story. But one of the things that I've learned from Spiwei in the years since I met her at that meeting is a certain kind of literacy, because you have to know what you're looking for to be able to see HIV, because as we were saying earlier, people don't die in this public way. And so she showed me the fields where nothing was growing. In this village, everybody was too sick. She sort of pointed at them and said, "What are they growing there?" And, you know, I'm a city girl. I had no clue. I said, "I don't know, sorghum? I don't know." And she said, "No, nothing. There's nothing planted there because there's no one there to do the farming." And you also have to, you drive into a village like this and you see some people and you say hello, but you have to do what Spiwei did, which is go in door to door, go into each house and see who's there or who's not there. In many cases, it's the people who were the parents who are no longer there, and it's just the kids left fending for themselves. But Spiwei, being Spiwei, she was one of the first people in Swaziland to come out and say that she was living with HIV, and she's created this organization, Swaziland Positive Living, to help people feel safe saying publicly that they're infected, and to start taking care of some of those orphans and the sick people. And in her typical fashion of just this sort of extraordinary strength, nothing daunts her. She went into this village and she helped them set up a sort of farming project so that there was food for people to eat, food to give the orphans who had no one feeding them anymore, and also produce to take into the city and sell so that they could raise some money. one of the sort of more poignant aspects of all of that is that the primary thing they needed the money for was funerals. They didn't even have the money left to bury the people who died of AIDS anymore.
Hmm. There are a number of orphans. Orphans we come across orphans throughout the stories of 28 stories of AIDS in Africa. There's a chapter in the book that introduces us to two orphans in Ethiopia. Tell us about them.
Their names are Tigist and Johannes Haile Michael, and they live in a little house made out of scraps of tin that's the size of your typical American bus shelter. And they've been on their own. When I met them, they were 14 and 10 or 13 and 9, something like that. They were a little fuzzy on dates because, of course, there was they're orphans and there was no one around really keeping track of birthdays. But they've been on their own since, I guess, the older girl was about 9 and her brother was 5 or 6. And their mom died of AIDS. Their father had died years earlier. And they took their mom's body back to the village to bury her. And when the funeral was over, their aunt and uncle said, well, you must come and live with us now. There's no one left in the city. And the kids looked around and they saw children doing all the things that you do in rural Ethiopia to help your family survive, carry firewood and fetch water and plow. And they didn't see a school. And even though their mom had been very poor living in this slum in Addis Ababa, she had kept them in school. And they said, actually, no, thank you. We're going to go home. And it sounds maybe a bit cold, but their aunts and uncles let them go because they had more orphans than they could care for already. And the kids went back to their city, and they've been living on their own in the city ever since. And they make a little money. Tigist braids hair, and Johannes shines shoes. And they do quite well in school. And Johannes isn't old enough to really remember his mom or dad at all, but Tigist remembers, and she tries her best to do the things a mother would do. She says to Johannes, you know, don't pick your scabs and do your homework and wash your uniform. And she's doing the best that she can at the age of 12 or 13 to be a mom.
Yeah. How does she think of the future? Is that something that she thinks about?
She does. I mean, they both have ambitions. Johannes would like to be a nurse, and Tigist thinks that she might like to teach or maybe do start a little sort of roadside restaurant business. But they're secondary school is really expensive, and she knows she's not really going to be able to pay for it. And when she thinks about the future, I think it's with a lot of anxiety. There's a lot of worry, and she has a sense that somebody else ought to be helping her figure this stuff out, but there isn't anybody. And they both know that they're enormously vulnerable. There are millions of orphans in Ethiopia, thousands and thousands of kids living on the streets, and of course, they're at huge risk of Tigist in particular will be at huge risk of sexual exploitation as she gets a little older.
Yeah. In Zambia, 1 in 3 children is an orphan, and 2/3 of the country's orphans are in the care of grandparents. So what of the others? There are a lot of other kids living out on their own.
Yeah, I mean, they're living with, there's this crazy phenomenon that in the rather sterile language of the AIDS business is called serial orphaning, but you get these kids whose parents die and they go to the aunts, and then the aunts die and they go to the grannies, and the grannies die and they go to the neighbors until there's no one left. The kids who don't have a granny, don't have someone caring for them, a lot of them are on the streets, and others are in houses where, like with Tigist, the oldest kid does the work. I have to tell you, Celeste, it's a bizarre feeling to go into one of these little houses and start talking to the kids, and I'll be waiting for mom to come home so that I can also interview her. And I think, you know, she's gone to the city to sell something she grew, or she's gone for wood or something. And gradually I realize that, in fact, no adult is coming home, that this, that these kids are doing their best on their own. And for the oldest kids, you know, for girls like Tigist especially, I always find it a little bit heartbreaking because they had, you know, you asked what she thinks about for the future. I mean, a lot of these kids had dreams or ambitions, and mom dies, and you're oldest, and so you're stuck. And whatever thoughts you may have had about going to secondary school or going to the hairdressing college, that's all out the window because you're in charge now, and if anyone's going to feed these kids, it's up to you, even if you're only 11.
Yeah. There's one scene in the book where you thought maybe you had come across a school, and it was the home of a woman by the name of Regine Mamba.
It was a little bit like the old woman who lived in a shoe who had children. She didn't know what to do. She all of Regine's kids but one have now passed away. She had eight, and she took in their children so that when I met her, there were, I think, 13. And she was 75, and she should have, by Zambian standards, she should have been sitting under a tree kind of being taken care of, you know? I mean, that's more than enough time to retire and enjoy your old age. And instead, she was up every morning working so hard to try and take care of these kids and just haunted by the anxiety of what would happen to them when she died. I mean, no one's going to take in all 13 or 14 of these orphans together. They would be scattered around, and she really didn't know what would happen.
Yeah. That is something that comes through so clearly in the story, is in a number of these stories, is the great care that people, the great love that they have for one another. And that there was actually a Ugandan doctor who said what saved her first and foremost was the love and support of her family.
Yeah, her name is Lydia Mungerera, and she got infected in the early 1990s when there was very little HIV treatment available in Africa and massive stigma around the disease. And Lydia's family, Lydia's own husband had died of HIV and never tested because he was so, you know, I think he and Lydia both knew very well what he had, but he didn't want to have to admit to people that that's what it was. And Lydia's, you know, the experience of millions of other women is that when they say they have HIV, their families, because of the fear associated with the disease, still want nothing further to do with them. But Lydia's family completely rallied and brought her home to Uganda from South Africa, where she'd been working, and sold everything they had to try and buy her the first AIDS drugs that were available, and stayed by her bedside nursing her. And she says, you know, of course I'm lucky that I'm from a wealthy family, and I'm lucky they had things to sell and we had these resources, but primarily what saved me was that they loved me and they weren't going to let me go without completely fighting to try and keep me alive.
Yeah. Fear and shame continues to be a problem, but it also seems that maybe that is beginning to change as well.
It is. That's one of the big differences that I've seen in the 4 years that I've been reporting on this story, is that as more and more people are infected, as more people are brave enough to come out and say that they're living with the virus, and especially as treatment becomes available, as HIV very gradually transitions from being a certainly fatal illness to one where at least there is hope that you may survive, it is starting to lessen the fear, and you hear fewer of the horrible stories of people being completely ostracized or even beaten, as some people in this book were. But you do, it's not gone, for sure.
Yeah. There's a story of a Zimbabwean woman, very brave woman. Forgive me if I'm going to mispronounce her name here.
Well, it'd be a gold star if you get it right, because it's a hard one.
I'll take a stab at it. Prisca Moholo.
That wasn't bad. It's Prisca.
Prisca, okay.
And it's Mkhlolo, but it's one of those, that's a tricky Southern African click in her surname. Prisca was infected very early, found out she had HIV very early by African standards in the mid-1980s. And when she told her family, they physically attacked her, and she was cut off by almost everyone. And her husband, who also knew he was infected, would not, before he died and she went public, forbade her completely to tell anyone. And, it's an interesting thing, because people will, as happened to Prisca, people will know very well or certainly suspect what's wrong with you. But if you don't test, then you don't know for sure, and so you can still count on the support and care of your neighbors. Whereas if you do, people say, well, why don't people get tested? Well, why test? If there's no treatment and they're not going to be able to do anything for you, why find out that's what you have? If it just means that people will ostracize you or, in Prisca's case, beat you with bottles and benches and old shoes.
She told you something that I thought was just really spot on. She said, this confidentiality is killing a lot of people. This fear of speaking out and the confidentiality of testing. And that is reflected in another story, a Burundi man who told you we must have openness.
Yeah, he's a fellow named Noé Sabisaba, who's from Burundi and was a refugee from Burundi civil war for a long time. in refugee camps in Tanzania. He found out by accident that he was infected when he tried to be a blood donor for an emergency surgery. And when he found out, his natural instinct was to go public, and his wife pleaded with him not to do that because, you know, there they were, refugees dependent on aid agencies for survival and on the kindness of their neighbors, and she was so afraid of what would happen if people knew they had HIV. But Noe, he's a teacher, and he was worried about his students, and he saw young female students in the camp who were scrabbling to survive like everyone else, selling sex to aid agency workers, to men in the local community, and was really worried about them being vulnerable. And he wanted to say, you can get infected. I got infected. This is, you know, this is not just something that you hear about on the radio. It really happens. And it wasn't until actually his wife died of AIDS that he was able to do that. And as he had predicted, a lot of the older people in the camp completely shunned him, well, as his wife had predicted they would. But when Noe organized the first kind of group meeting at the camp to talk about HIV, it was his students, it was young people. When he first began to talk, they burst into a song. And he was very surprised because it's a song that they sing in Burundi for heroes, for people who have fought well in battles. And he gradually realized that they were singing it for him, and it was in recognition of his courage in saying that he had the disease and in trying to get other people to talk about it.
Hmm. And his organization is another example of a grassroots organization that is on the ground and fighting.
They are. Noe, he was an organization of one initially, but people gradually came to join him. They started something called Stop SIDA, S-I-D-A, which is the French acronym for AIDS. And by the time Noe was repatriated, there's peace in Burundi now, and he went home in 2005. And by the time he went home from the refugee camp, they had managed, many more people had come out and said publicly they had the disease. They'd done lots of education. They actually had better HIV services because of Noe's work in these refugee camps that they had in the peaceful communities surrounding them. And now he's back in Burundi trying very hard to do that work in the country as it's rebuilding after the civil war.
How does the story of AIDS in Africa differ from one country to another?
It differs in lots and lots of ways, and I think that's one of the things that we, we forget. We think it's one big monolithic story, but most areas in West Africa, like, for example, Liberia, where your caller was from, have very low rates of HIV infection, and, well, comparatively low, higher than ours in North America, but low by African standards, between about 1 and 5%, primarily because they have a much less infectious strain of the virus. HIV comes in two types, and the one they have in West Africa is much harder to catch. It's also true that in West and North Africa, where circumcision is much more widely practiced, we now know that male circumcision offers great protection against HIV, offers about 60% protection. And so areas where culturally most men are circumcised will also have lower HIV rates. In East and Southern Africa, the rates are much, much higher, down to numbers in the mid-30s in Southern Africa. It used to be that you could identify two or three countries that were really engaged in mounting a response. And certainly Uganda started in the early 1980s before anyone else did and brought their infection rates down very successfully. These days, I'm happy to say, I don't really go anywhere where the government is not passionately engaged in responding to the pandemic and working really hard to get people on treatment. There are still governments that are more open, that are more open both in talking about the disease and that have done a better job of being accountable in funding that they get from international agencies. And so, of course, more people are willing to, more aid agencies are willing to go in there and do that work. And there's still a huge difference in people's economies. If you are one of the little countries in Southern Africa, Lesotho, Botswana, Swaziland, Mozambique is another one, I mean, a bigger country, but very, very dependent on migrant labor. And if you are still a country that relies on sending young men to go away and work in the mines of South Africa or the tobacco plantations in Zimbabwe, then you will consequently still usually have an even greater problem with HIV infection.
Yeah. Sexual transmission, of course, is one of the ways that AIDS is transmitted, but also unsafe blood supplies, reuse of unsterilized medical equipment, sharing of razors for traditional scarring or circumcision or prison tattoos, car accidents, violent crime. These are some of the other ways that AIDS is transmitted that I'm reading this from your book. What are governments and NGOs doing in terms of addressing these issues?
Oh, that's an excellent question, which unfortunately doesn't really have an easy answer. The primary form of transmission is sex, and so that has been the focus of most of the interventions. It's very difficult without sort of doing up close, very carefully monitored research on use of needles, that kind of thing, to know how much of a source of transmission that is. And of course, if you have someone who has a blood transfusion but who also has unprotected sex, you're never going to know how they got infected. So we don't actually know. It is dawning on people that if you have what's called a generalized epidemic, if you have so much of your population infected, then that all of these other things are going to be a serious risk for people, and that there needs to be much greater effort paid attention to safe blood supplies. There's a lot of work going on in working with traditional healers or elders in communities who are responsible for things like, for example, in a lot of Southern Africa, young men are not, Southern and Eastern Africa, young men are circumcised at the age of 13 or even as old as 20. There's a lot of work to get the people who do the circumcisions, the people who do ritual scarring or tattooing, to use sterilized equipment, to use the occasions when they do that work to also do AIDS education. I still worry a lot when I go to for example, in Zimbabwe or Malawi, a very underserved rural clinic struggling for resources where they may get one box of latex gloves a year. I have certainly seen lots of what we would consider extremely unsafe medical conditions. And while I think people have the basic education now to protect themselves, it's also true that if they just deliver, you don't get any more needles. What are you going to do, right? Mm-hmm. You're left with the choice of not giving someone a life-saving injection of a drug or using a needle that may or may not be sterile. It's a huge concern.
Mm-hmm. This is The Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Stephanie Nolan. She's a journalist. She is dedicated solely to covering AIDS in Africa. She is the Africa correspondent for Toronto's Globe and Mail. She's also the author of 28 Stories of AIDS in Africa. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with a telephone call. I invite your questions and comments. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's talk with another listener, a caller in Urbana, on line one. Hi.
Hi. My question is, how do you prevent burnout in this horrible profession? And also, how do you prevent depression? Thank you. And I'll listen all the time.
Okay. Burnout and depression.
My own or...
I think that's what she would like you to address. And then I also think, people like Regine Mamba and people who are living with this pandemic and trying to cope as best they can, how do they keep going?
Well, I mean, that's an excellent question, because there will be, Regine has in the last couple of years become the target of some very limited support, helping her with uniforms for her kids to go to school, her grandchildren to go to school, and blankets and things like that. There has been a push to provide both medicines and some material support in some of these worst-hit areas, but very few people are talking about doing the psychological work that somebody who loses all of their own children, so, mm-hmm. There's a monumental amount of grief associated with that. There's never discussions about helping people deal with grief and the loss that accompanies this kind of devastation. And then also the stress, the day-to-day anxiety of trying to raise 13 kids on your own when you're 75. Regine had become part of a group, the grandmothers in her community, Raising Orphans, had organized themselves just to meet and talk every couple of days, and she was finding considerable comfort and solace in that. But it is true, by and large, that as the huge push and the energy goes into trying to rule out AIDS treatment to keep more people alive, there isn't a lot of conversation left over for what they call in the AIDS business psychosocial support. Remarkably little of that happens. In terms of my own, my own sort of spending time in communities like this, this is going to sound weird, but it's actually very rarely depressing. Speedway takes me driving in her little white truck, and we visit these places where awful things are happening. But in every one of those communities, Speedway has organized people to take care of each other and to fight back, to fight the people who would ostracize them, to fight the government who doesn't want to hear from people with AIDS, to take on our governments, which they feel have not been quick enough to support them, to take on pharmaceutical companies that, you know, charge exorbitant prices for the drugs that they need to stay alive. And I meet so many incredibly courageous, resilient, compassionate people who are mounting these response efforts that it's, in fact, often incredibly exhilarating to do this job rather than depressing.
A lot of hope in the story.
There really is.
Yeah. Let's take another call. A listener in Farina, line 4. Hi.
Hi. You must be part of that left-wing, bleeding-heart liberal media. I'm just teasing. To bring light to a story like this, I can see it takes personal courage on your part, and that last caller hit it on the head. How do you not suffer from compassion fatigue? I believe in the average American and most people around the world have a deep, deep sense of compassion when they find out about the suffering of especially children and others. My question, I'll preface with a quick comment. This Bush administration is a criminal administration for the money they throw away. The Pentagon budget, just to start. Now, when Bush was in Africa on his tour in 2003, he just about broke both of his arms, patting himself on the back about how much they were going to spend in Africa. I find out later that it was conditional to buy American companies' drugs, and it was a loan. Could you comment on that, and what actually the American government, in the face of the kind of money they're throwing away in other ways, how could money that's donated by a government like a rich government like the United States or European, how could it best be spent? And could you comment about the duplicity of the Bush's quote-unquote Africa AIDS thing? I heard it was a loan, too. It wasn't even a grant.
No, it is actually grants. And here's a crazy comment from the left-wing bleeding heart liberal media, of which I'm proud to be a member. The Bush AIDS program in Africa is terrific. I'm Canadian, so we don't spend a lot of time saying nice things
about
your government.
You hardly hear anything about it.
You never hear about it. And, you know, I think that they are criticized for, far be it from me as a Canadian to say legitimately or not, but for lots and lots of things. But you actually very rarely hear about the value of what they've done in Africa. Now, it's incredibly controversial for three reasons. The first is what you mentioned, the use of brand name American drugs. And they did at the outset insist that all of these programs they were funding use brand name American drugs. Certainly, the perception on the part of Africans was that was to protect the American pharmaceutical industry and not out of any legitimate concern about the health of Africans.
Right.
That has really changed. These days they use, I think the latest number is 43 different generic drugs that are used in their AIDS program in Africa, and that's obviously made it possible for them to treat far more people. Those drugs are usually about 5 times cheaper. The program also has an insistence that anyone that they fund or work with in Africa, they have to sign a pledge essentially condemning prostitution. And that's really complicated for people because obviously people who do sex work and people who are forced into selling sex because they need to survive, they're a huge driver of the epidemic, and they're people you have to work with if you're going to work with AIDS in Africa. So that has been a real struggle. And again, the perception in Africa is that's driven by particularly a religious agenda in the United States more than it is out of any concern for Africans. The third thing concerns abstinence, and the Bush program is called PEPFAR, the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, and it's required in the legislation that created the program that a third of the spending go on prevention of HIV transmission and that a third of that spending go on abstinence. And that's obviously really complicated in an African context, beyond the fact that there's very little research to show that abstinence education actually prevents the transmission of HIV. I mean, it's just not backed up by the numbers. But additionally, the the people most at risk of HIV transmission in Africa are married monogamous women. Well, how is abstinence relevant for them? It's really not. And so the emphasis on abstinence is seen as, again, being a response to a political constituency in the United States that has nothing to do with what Africans really need. Those three things notwithstanding, the Bush administration is a massive distributor of condoms across Africa. I think at this point they are the largest provider of condoms, of free condoms. They have, I think it's 850,000 people by this point on HIV treatment that they're providing free through African government health systems. And they've done fantastic work about providing the drugs that prevent a pregnant woman with HIV from transmitting the virus to her baby. And PEPFAR, almost everywhere that I've seen it, moves quickly, is responsive, does good accounting of how that money is used, helps support the training of local people, building their capacity to do the work themselves. They've actually done really, really good work. And maybe because their image at this point is so clouded by other stuff, I think that they really don't get the credit for that they should.
Okay, where could money be spent the most effectively? And I'll hang up. Thank you.
You're welcome. I'm really glad you asked this question. I think that, money on a national level, I would say that the U.S. is more or less doing the right things. Funding treatment and funding the transmission of the virus to babies are the two most important things you can do. Things like orphan care are obviously really important, but more important is, in fact, keeping the parents alive so that there's actually people to look after those kids, look after their own kids, look after nieces and nephews. On a more practical level, a lot of people ask me, well, what can I do? I want to get involved. And I think it's important to recognize that you're already involved. We talked about these kids who aren't in school. Zambia, the kids, Regine's kids, she struggles to keep them in school because you got to pay school fees. Well, they charge school fees in Zambia because the World Bank says they have to. Who has more influence than anybody else on World Bank policy? The United States. You want to do something about taking care of orphans in Africa, the most useful thing you can do is join a campaign to write letters about school fees in Africa. I think that we're very quick to say, I want to send $100 to pay for some orphans to go to school, and that's obviously really important, and I encourage people to do it, but we're much slower to see the connections to our own lives, our own governments, and the things that we're doing that have a huge impact every day on how the pandemic plays out in Africa.
Mm. We've got one more caller to go here, and we're running down on time, so quickly to Northern Illinois, line one. Hi.
Good afternoon. How is everybody today?
Fine. How are you?
I'm doing okay. It's a nice sunny day.
Okay. Well,
I'll tell you, you guys are talking about drugs in general, talking about this whole thing with drugs. I've had an experience just recently where my mom has asthma. I had to go, and the doctor prescribed her some drugs, all right? She said she had to go to the Walgreens or place like that to get the prescription. So we go there, $300 a pill, which is outrageous. Okay, now, and the reason I'm bringing this back, is that she went back to the doctor again and complained about it, and the guy just gave her some pills, a whole slew of them, enough to last a month, free. Okay, and the reason I'm bringing this up is that we're struggling here. And seniors, I've seen it with my folks. My dad's going through cancer. I've got big health issues on my end of the, for my parents. And yet we're spending more time and more money in other places. I don't think that's fair to us here as a country. We're spending more money in this country, out of this country, than taking care of our own kind.
And I'm going to jump in here because we're really short on time now. I don't know, Stephanie, do you want to address the comments of the caller?
I guess I would just say, I would very quickly say two things. One is that, in fact, you don't spend more money. Well, you may spend more money on wars in other places. You really don't spend it on money in foreign aid. The United States is, per capita, the second smallest foreign aid donor in the world, and I think maybe there's still some lingering misconceptions here about how much you choose to give in assistance elsewhere. And then I would say that I'm sorry for your caller's family problems, and obviously those things are a struggle everywhere, but maybe that helps him understand how devastating it is in a place like Zambia to have those health issues in your family, but to be living in a community where one in three people, one in four people has a fatal illness, so there's nowhere to turn for support. In fact, there's probably not even a doctor to go back to ask for medicines because your doctor's also died of the disease. Obviously, people here have huge problems, but the scale of the problem in a country where one in four people has an illness like AIDS just really doesn't compare.
Mm-hmm. Stephanie, thank you so much for talking with us this afternoon.
Thank you so much for having me.
Stephanie Nolan has been our guest in this portion of the program. She is the author of 28 Stories of AIDS in Africa. She'll be in Chicago tomorrow, May 10th, 2007, for a speaking engagement at the Chicago Council on Foreign Affairs on East Ontario, that event, 6:30 p.m. Tickets are required, but they are free, and if you need to check into that, give them a call at the Chicago Council on Foreign Affairs. Stephanie Nolan's book, 28 Stories of AIDS in Africa, is published by Walker & Company.